Right, we're holding the second line from the bottom of nimdalanone base. We're going to start with a little piece if I got to. We talked yesterday about an important difference between the first dibris in Yisra and the second one in Rosh Hanan, namely that in the first, when it comes to Shabbos, by the in Yisra it just says Abrachah v'amotzo v'amtecha, and in Luchos Shniyos besides v'amtecha it added also v'shorcha v'chamorcha v'chol v'amtecha. And we discussed what we learned from the shor, what we learned from chamor, and what we learned from the v'chol. The dinim apply to all animals, and we use them as zeta shava to say also that the fact that it applies to all animals also applies to other areas in Torah as well, kalayim, chasima, etc. So, in this connection, shor of chanina ben ogilus of chiba abba, mepnei ma b'dibris rishonus le'nema behem toiv, why is it that in the first dibris, in Yisrael, it does not say toiv, or b'dibris achronus, nema behem toiv, whereas in the second one, it does mention the concept of Tov. It says by Kibud Avein. In the first Dibris, it says Kavod Kavicha Vesemecha Laman Yarichun Yemecha. In the second Dibris, it adds Laman Yarichun Yemecha Ulaman Yitav Loch, which is Tov. Yeah, the same church. So why does it not say Tov in the first Loch in the first Dibris?
It
specifically mentions Yitav by the Dibra of Kavod Kavicha Vesemecha, but it's actually more generally. Why doesn't it mention, actually, it's not only Tov, actually, as we'll see as we go through the Gemara, there's actually no Tes at all. Tes is the only letter that's missing, actually, in the first Dibris, in Yisrael. Every other letter of the Aleph phase is there, except the Tes. Never mind you asking me why it does or it doesn't say Tov in one or the other one. Shailanium Nema Behem Tov. Better you should start by asking me whether in fact it says Tov in them. Sha'ini Yadeim Nema Behem Tov in Lav. I don't know whether it says Tov in them or not. Now, what does he mean? Does he mean literally that he didn't know, that he wasn't familiar with Pesukim? So there's actually Billy Nashas, so the Kivega references here a Tosfos in Brother Basra that says exactly that. Yes, we do find Tosfos refers to our Gemara over here, that yes, it may be that some of the Amoraim were not so familiar with Pesukim. So it seems hard to say. Nevertheless, there are a couple of Meforshim who take that at face value. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, for example, defends it in one of his Tvarim. He points out, we know that Tvarim Shabbat, you're not allowed to say Baal Peh. You have to have to read them, or you have to read them from a Sefer Torah or whatever, a scroll.
Meaning
exactly what it sounds like. You're not supposed to be saying Baal Peh. I mean, there's various rules and regulations about that. You're allowed to, ones that everybody is familiar with, like Shema, et cetera, whatever. It talks about in Shulchan Aruch the details of it, but in principle, you're not allowed to say Dvorim Shavit Sad, you're not allowed to say Baal Peh. We learned about it in Gittin. So therefore, he argues, Sforim may have been very expensive, and they're not always available, and therefore, yes, there may have been individual Amoraim who weren't really so familiar with Pesukim. Most of the other Meforshim say that, come on, that it's very hard to believe. Very hard to believe. So they have all kinds of different explanations of what Rabbi Chiya Ba'ava meant. Among them, a couple of different malachim. One of them is that he's saying, you're assuming that the difference between Yisrael and Rosh Hanan is the difference between the first and second set of Dibris. Says who? Maybe, in fact, just like we know that Zachar v'Shomer b'Dibra Echad, even though Zachar is said in Yisrael and Shomer is said in Rosh Hanan, maybe by the same token then, both the ones in Yisrael and the ones in Rosh Hanan are what the Eivishter said the first time around, and therefore, there's no question, therefore you can't ask why it doesn't say Tov in the first Dibris. It does. It just in one place, the Torah records one version of it, and the other, it records the other version of it. But he's asking Dibris that are shown us versus not, implying as if as if there's the first luchos versus the second. It sounds like he's saying the first luchos versus the second luchos. So he's answering back, not necessarily just because you have it written in two places in the Torah doesn't mean that one's the first luchos and one's the second luchos. There's lots of other explanations also. Another variation on that, I think Pnei Yeshua talks about, is the possibility that maybe, so ultimately we do have is the variations between Yisra and Rosh Hanan. If the Eivishter said them both together, which ones were written on the Luchos, we showed us that is, Rav Chiya Bava is saying, maybe what it is, so there's certain things, it's sort of like we have in Chumash Kriyuksiv, we have a Kriyuksiv, and we have words in Tanakh that are supposed to be written and not read, and vice versa, as we learned in the Dorim. Maybe this was the same kind of thing. Maybe the Eivishter verbally said, Laman Yitzav Lach, but he didn't tell Moshe to write it on, or he himself didn't write it on the wall. So that's all one mahalach that Mefoshim had to explain what Rav Chiya Bava is answering. There's others, including that he's saying, you're assuming that Laman Yitzav Lach implies Toiv, a Gashmiyastika Toiv. Who says? We learned back in Kedushin, we also discussed it at the end of Fulin, the possibility that Laman Yitzav Lach actually means Lo'olam Shekulo Toiv. It means good and Olam Haba. So you're assuming it doesn't say Toiv, a Gashmiyastika Toiv in the first Dibur, it's only in the second one, but who says the second one is talking about a Gashmiyastika Toiv either?
And the second one is what?
So then the loyalum shikolei toy would mean for the world, that's all good, meaning not a matter, yeah. Anyway, so he says, so I don't know. Either, again, literally he means I don't know what it says in the first versus the second Dibros, or he means I don't know if you're correct in your assumption that the two versions represent two different sets of Dibros, or I don't know if you're correct in your assumption that toiv actually means the kind of toiv that you're thinking of. So therefore, he tells him, "Klochei to Reb Tanchum Bachaniloi." So take yourself over to Reb Tanchum Bachaniloi. Show your rogel etzer of Yishuv and Levi. He used to be a regular Talmud by Reb Yishuv and Levi. Klochei means go. I mean, go for yourself. It's sort of like a short version of lech lecha. So go to Tanchum Bachaniloi. Show your rogel etzer of Yishuv and Levi. He was a regular by Reb Yishuv and Levi. Show your boki by Agada. And Rabbi Shlomo Levi was an expert in Agada, so he'll be able to answer you. Also, like a base, he goes to Rav Tanchum. Amalei, mimenu lo shamaiti. As a matter of fact, I didn't hear anything about it from Rabbi Shlomo Levi. Ela kach amalei Shmuel bar Nochum achi imo sherab Acha bar Chanina. But Shmuel bar Nochum, the uncle of Rav Acha bar Chanina, did tell me an explanation. Or another version is that the Shmuel bar Nochum wasn't his uncle, but rather his grandfather. That either way. The explanation is however social lishtaber, because the first luchos ended up getting broken. So therefore, so that's the question. Social lishtaber my abi. So what? Okay, the first luchos had to be broken. What's that got to do with the there not being laman? Yeah. The answer is Amar Rav Ashi chas v'shalom posta tova mi Yisrael. If it had said Tov, or even just the letter Tes, because the Gemara is going to say soon that Tov represents that the letter Tes represents Tov. The Gemara is going to say in a minute. That if it had said the word Toiv or any form of it or whatever in the first Lukas, then the breaking of them would have meant that Toiv would have ceased from the Jewish people, Chas v'Shalom. And therefore, because the Eivishter knew in advance that the first Lukas are destined to be broken, we know the famous thing that Amman talks about, that the Eivishter Yediyah doesn't foresaw the Chira, that even though the Eivishter knows what's going to happen in the future, we still have the Chira. But the Eivishter knew that the first Lukas are going to end up broken, and therefore Bedavka, he made sure that it doesn't say Toiv or any form of it or even the letter Tes on them, because otherwise the breaking of them would symbolize that Toiv is gone.
The Psukim were completed on the Lukas, or they like we see them?
No, they were complete on Noshi Hashem Alei Techa Asher Tzitzit Hamayim Tzitzit Hamayim, etc. Yeah. Marsha, by the way, what Marsha says about this, I'll talk about after the next piece about the significance of the letter Tes. But anyway, so that's the first thing. So because the first Lukas were destined to be broken, whereas the second Lukas weren't, so the second Lukas it could say Laman Yitzav Lach. I'm Rabbi Shua. In this connection, Rabbi Shua says, on the side over here, it says that actually it's Rabbi Shua ben Levi says, if somebody sees a letter Tes in his dream, it's a good simon for him. Question in my timer. You're going to tell me because Tes is the initial of the word Toiv. Never mind that. Ema, but if that's the case, the letter Tes, yes, it can represent Toiv, but it can also represent something bad, like the Pasuk said, the Pasuk in Yeshaya, speaking about the destruction of about the total destruction of Babel. It says b'tetetia of a matate hashmed, I will sweep it with the broom of destruction. Matate, the broom. So it's a story in a couple of places, Shas and Rosh Hashanah and Megillah, that the Rebbe's Talmidim didn't know what the pasuk meant until one day they heard Rebbe's maidservant telling somebody take a matate and sweep the house, and then they understood that it means the broom. But anyway, the point is that a test of their Abadaba represents destruction. Then to his Chad test, Kamrinan. Yes, but we're talking about the person saw in his dream one single test. The Titetia and the Mafate has two. Okay? Eima Tumasa B'Shulecha, fine, but one test can just as well represent the pasuk from Eicha, Tumasa B'Shulecha, her Tuma is on the hems of her skirt, like where everybody can see it.
Shulecha
means the hem of a skirt, the hem of a garment, is it called Shulecha. I mean, the bottom of it. Meaning, in other words, the figure of speech is like if you have the previous pasuk talks about Arkeim Nida HaYotza, that your Shulecha is like a Nida. So now you have Tumasa B'Shulecha, like her Tuma is openly visible on the hem of her skirt, like everybody can see how degraded she is. So a test can represent that. The answer is Tet Beis Kamen. Okay, maybe we're talking about that a person saw in a dream the letters Tet and Beis. That more represents the word Toif. Okay, problem is Eima Tovu B'Artes Shareha. Fine, but it can also stand for, we have a pasuk that begins with Tet Beis and is also, in a negative sense, another pasuk from Eicha, in Perek Beis. We know each of the first four prakim of Eicha is arranged in Aleph Beis order. In the second parak, the test pasuk begins with Tovu B'Artes Shareha. The gates of the Beis Mikdash sank into the ground. So Vayter Tet Beis is not necessarily a positive thing. Ella, no. Going back, never mind Tet Beis. The reason why Tet is a sign of goodness is because the Torah first begins with it as Torah. Because in the very first time that the Torah uses the letter test is after Vayara Kimasa'ur Ki Torah. So therefore, because of that, a test represents goodness, even though it can also be used in negative places also. So that's also the connection with the previous Gemara, that was the point, therefore, that's why there's no test. That's why there was no test in the first Divrei, yeah. Because they were destined to be then Tova would have been gone.
Who says that?
So that's why the Gemara is putting them together. But I'll tell you a couple of interesting things on it. First of all, speaking of Psukim and Eicha, Marsha has a long, interesting explanation over here about the deeper significance of, he talks about, if you look in Eicha, in the first parak, so the Gemara has quoted the test pasuk from the first parak, Tumasa B'Shulecha, the test pasuk from the second parak, Tovu B'Artes Shareha. Then if you continue in Eicha, the third parak, and this is, we're coming up to Tisha B'Av now, so it's something to keep in mind for then. In the third parak, each letter of the Aleph Beis, there's three psukim that begin with that letter. And in the third parak, all three of those psukim begin with the word Toiv. And then in the fourth parak, the test pasuk also begins with Toivim. So he says, what's the verse? We know the history of Sefer Eicha. Yirmiyo wrote it, as the wrote parak Aleph Beis and Dalet. That the Eibishter told him have it read in front of King Yehoyakim and the ministers and whatever, maybe they'll get scared and do tshuva. They didn't. In fact, Yehoyakim took it and cut it up and threw it in the fire. Then the Eibishter told Yirmiyahu to rewrite it. So he rewrote those three psukim and also inserted Perek Gimel with the triple alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
No, they didn't listen. The point is that's the Sefer Eicha that we have.
Why he took first the 1, 2, and 4?
Those were the original psukim, each of which has one alphabet. Afterwards, when Yaakim burnt it, the Nebuchadnezzar told him, write those over again and also add another parak, which is going to be similar to it's going to be like the equivalent of all those three because it's got three times as many psukim. Anyway, the verdict is, Marsha develops the idea that once the Megillah was burnt, along with it is the parak that had the Tovim as the test. That it means they'll never be good, that the significant thing will be the Tumasa B'Shulecha on the Tovu B'Artes Shareha. Therefore, when he rewrote it, when the Eibishter told him to rewrite it, he made sure, B'Ruach HaKodesh, that all three psukim from Perek Gimel, which is now the new Perek, all has Toiv to represent that there will be Toiv after all.
And the Eibishter dictated that.
No, the difference between Nevi'im and Ksuvim is that Nevi'im was the difference between the Torah and that, because Torah was dictated word by word by the Eibishter to Moshe Rabbeinu. Nevi'im and to a lesser extent Ksuvim, the Nevi'im wrote in their own words, but still he wrote it with Ruach HaKodesh, having this idea in mind, I shall say. Tell you also an interesting verse that I saw. I don't remember now from who that we have the pasuk in Tehillim says Ach Tov LiYisrael. So only Hashem is good for the Jewish people. So a remez in it is Ach. There's only 21 of the 22 letters of the Aleph Beis in the first Luchos, and that is totally Yisrael. That's good for us Jewish people, because if there had been the 22nd letter of the test in there, then we'd be in trouble. Since we're talking about things that you see in a dream, if somebody sees a hesped, a eulogy, in a dream, It should represent to him that they had Rachmanos on him in Shemayim, that Eibishter had Rachmanos on him and rescued him from death or some serious trouble. This is only when he sees the word hesped in writing, not when he sees an actual hesped, when he sees the word hesped written out. So why is it, Marsha and Marshal and various other Mepharshim talk about, because the word hesped, can, if you replace the hay with a ches, can be broken down to chok had. Chof means Yad Rachmanos, and Pad, Meloshin Pada. So therefore, though seeing the word Hesper represents the idea that Eibishter was Chof, Yad Rachmanos on him, Pada, that he redeemed him from death.
What do you connect? I mean, the Hey,
it's not the Hey. No, but Hey and Ches are interchangeable, but that's also one idea. Why Taka didn't he see the word Hesper? Why did he see Hesper? But Hey, a number of things, but one idea, but he just realized how close he was to there being an actual Hesper, only that Eibishter had Rachmanos on him, and then switched it around. Next, the Mishnah said that the same thing we said, the various dinim in the Mishnah apply not only to domesticated animals, but also to wild animals and also to birds. Omer Shlokish, Kan Shonu Rebbe, based on this Mishnah, we can see that Rebbe included also within the Mishnah the idea that also it's possible for there to be Talayim with birds. Like this, if it hadn't been in the Sefer Kelayim, when it talks about these dinim, it talks about domestic animals, it talks about wild animals, it doesn't talk about birds over there. Based on our Mishnah, we can infer that there is such a thing as Kelayim among birds as well. Therefore, between different species, even if they're fairly closely related. For example, Tarnagel, Tavas, so Kisyoni, Kelayim, Zabazet. For example, a Tarnagel, a chicken, a Tavas, which Rashi translates it here using a word that many Mepharshim said means a peacock, and Pisioni is some kind of quail. So all of those are Kalayim Zebazet. They're all different species, meaning that if you were to crossbreed one with the other, you would be over on an issue. Or I guess also if you had two of them pull a miniature wagon for you or something, yeah. The question is pshita. Well, okay, of course. I mean, they're different species. Yes, but the thing is, yes, but the thing is that these various kinds of birds are ravu together. So ravu, the Ravid explains that it means they ravu doesn't mean they fight. We wouldn't think they're the same species in that case. No, like somebody growing up. So he explains it means they hatch each other's eggs. If you put these various kinds of birds together, they'll nest on and then sit on and then incubate each other's eggs. So you would think, therefore, they're considered the same species? No. Based on the way that Rambam writes in Yad HaChazaka, Mepharshim on the Rambam, Rikurkus, I think it is, explains that the Rambam may understand Rovo Bahadi Adadi, meaning that they are fertile with each other. They are capable of interbreeding and producing offspring. So you would think that's close enough then that they should be considered one species?
No.
No, Kamashma Maudatem Machat Min Chadu, so you think in that case they're all one species. Kamashma one of the Chiddush that not.
A Tarnagel,
a Tavas, which is a peacock, a peafowl, or Pisioni and quail.
Quail is what is
that? Quail is a little fat little bird, it's a slug that the Jewish people have in the desert, is one species of it. Actually, another word for it is pheasant, which actually the word pheasant is the same as the word Pisioni here in the Gemara. They both come from the same Greek word.
Mm.
Nobody said it is. Okay. Omer Shmuel. So in this connection, Shmuel also says, Avas a bird, Kalayim Zebazet. A goose, a domestic goose that is, and a wild goose are Kalayim with each other. Again, you're not allowed to crossbreed them, you're not allowed them to do work together. So Maskifle Rav Barofan and my timer. Why are you saying that they're considered two separate species? Now, just because one's domestic and one's wild doesn't make them two different species. And in Kalayim, it mentions over there various types of animals, various types of plants. We have a cultivated and a wild one, and they're not considered Kalayim. So what's the difference between that? There's rules about it. The Yerushalmi and Kalayim has a lot of discussion about what exactly the rules are to determine whether they're one species or not, how similar they look, how in the case of plants, how similar the fruit tastes. How similar the leaves are shaped in the case of animals, how similar their behaviors are, etc. So what is the difference between one and the other that would make them be considered two separate species? Are you going to tell me because one has a one? Are you going to tell me because one has a thick kua and one has a thin kua. Usually kua, okay, usually kua in the Gemara usually means a neck. And in fact, in the neckline, actually, when the Gemara talks about camels, it does mean that. Here, though, Rashi explains that kua actually means a beak. I don't know why Rashi had the need to say that kua doesn't mean the neck. Maybe he was bothered by that wild beast and domestic beast. Both have the same kind of neck. I don't know. Anyway. So you're going to tell me that that's...
Here it means the beak.
So here Rashi says it means the beak. So you're going to tell... Usually it means the neck. So you're going to tell me that the reason why a goose, a domestic and a wild goose, a phalayim, is because one has a big beak and one has a small beak? Elamayata, by that logic, gamla parasa, gamla taya. What about the two different kinds of donkeys? You have the Persian camel. The Persian camel and the taya, the Arabian camel. You can find pictures of both of them online. They call them, one's called a camel, the other's called a dromedary. One has one hump, one has two humps. The Gemara is focusing more. The dromedary is the Persian one. They call it Bactrian. No, the other way around, sorry. Yeah, the dromedary is the Arabian one. It's the one with the thin legs and the thin neck that you see all the time in the pictures. Yeah, and then you have a very shaggy kind that lives in Persia and Afghanistan and the native to there. The high alim kuei, the high cotton kuei. One has a thick neck and the other one has a thin neck. Pocket. I mean, do I have a kalayim over there? What are you going to tell me about? Is that kalayim with each other? And they're not. You're allowed to crossbreed those two different kinds of camels. Yeah, that's the point. So just because one has a thin neck and the other not, so you can't say in the case of the two geese, one has a thick beak and the other one has a thin beak, that should be enough to make them kalayim. No. Ella Amar Abaya, no, but there's a bigger difference. Zeb beis of machutz, zeb beis of mimufnim. One kind of the two kinds of geese. The wild goose, its basin, its genitals are more visible on the outside than the domestic one. So that's considered enough of a difference. That they're considered two separate species. Rapapama, there's another difference. Hotuna choda beis of a shichla. The one kind, the wild one, Rashi says, only lays one egg at a time. Hotuna kama beis of a shichla. Shichla means when it's fertilized. Only one egg starts developing at a time, and only after it lays that one does it start developing another one, the wild one. Whereas the domestic one, the house on a camabas of a shikla, whereas the domestic goose lays several eggs at one time. That's another difference.
Absolutely.
So all those are differences. I mean, one applies to the male, one applies to the female. The point is those are strong enough differences to make them be considered two species. Another case. If somebody crossbreeds two kinds of sea creatures, then he gets malchus because he's also been over on the history of Kilayim. Okay, so Tosfos actually says Tosfos actually wants to change the Girsa. The Rebbe Yehuda wants to say that it's not Hamarbia because you can't really crossbreed fish. Rather, he says that Girsa should be Hamani. If you, for example, if you have two different kinds of fish or two different kinds of sea creatures, pull a boat, let's say.
Yeah.
Just in the same way. You can't have a stir of a chamor the same way you can.
To read the
okay.
Fish, that's...
Yeah, okay. So Tosfos discusses the pros and cons of it. Maybe after all, there's a difference between fish and sea creatures. You know, not all creatures that live in the sea are fish, after all, right?
I found recent fish in a tree lodge in shells.
I didn't read about it. Okay. Anyway. So if you might be a two minim shabayam like this, my timer, why is that? And after all, you can't say it's because of the lemudim we said yesterday, because we mentioned behema chaya and oif, we never mentioned dogim. Amr of adab avam shmeidu ula, yes, but ask you leminehu mi abosha. Yes, you make a zera shava of the two places where it says leminehu. The Ibishta created all of the sea creatures, leminehu. And all the sea creatures and the birds and whatnot, Luminehu. And then later on it says, keeps looking later, it says they wish to create all the land animals, Luminehu. So just like when it comes to land animals, you have an Isser of Kalayim, again, both of course reading them or having the two of them pull a wagon or what have you. The same thing with sea creatures.
From the stair, yeah.
So now Rachba asks the question. Hamanig the izer v'shibuta mahu. What about if somebody has a wagon pulled by a goat and a shibuta? So shibuta is something that lives in the water. Rashi says that it's some kind of fish. And then there's a couple of gemaras in various places that mention the shibuta as a, no, not necessarily. No, because there's gemaras that mention it as a kosher fish. There's a Gemara in Shabbos, for example, that mentions that Rabbi used to salt the Shibuta l'kav of Shabbos. So it has to be some kind of kosher fish. Tosfos over here discusses the possibility that maybe it's Tosfos, some other Rishonim talk about that maybe it's some other kind of water creature, not necessarily a fish. Whatever it is, if you use the two of them together to pull a wagon, say Mabu, do you tie one rope from the wagon to a goat and the other one to a shibut? Mabu. So what would be the din? Do we say, well, the goat never goes in the water, the shibuta never comes out on dry land, therefore loy klum of it, so what he did doesn't count for anything. You can't call that an isur kilayim.
Because they have to be
ones that are capable of interbreeding. And like this, they're never going to, because they live in different different environments. Or maybe not. Maybe the Torah is saying that you're not allowed to have any two species pull a wagon together, and here you have two different species.
But
that doesn't matter. Maybe the Torah says you can't have two species, and that's it. No two species. We talked yesterday, by the way, that Amnon holds that the whole Isur D'oraita is only if one is a kosher and one is a Tshrefa, creature, which leads to a bit of discussion over here. First of all, if we say the shibuta is a kosher fish, and the goat obviously is a kosher goat, then is a kosher species, then how does that fit? How does that fit with what the Rambam saying? So they talk about maybe when we say loika over here, when we're asking the question, we're asking what about derabanan? The Rambam does agree that derabanan, you're not allowed to with two kosher or two non-kosher species. So we'd be asking derabanan, maybe the derabanan extended their issur even to a case like this, or maybe not. Nowadays we don't have malchus, so it's a moot point. You asked that yesterday as well. Yeah.
I know it's a moot point, but
what
does
the Mosa Mashiach? Well, no. Mosa Mashiach, the
Sanhedrin. We don't
remember the Allah. No. I don't know. I don't think it says in Shulchan. Anyway, Master for Ravina. Ravina asks on that. You're telling me that you think just because one lives on land and one lives in the water, it shouldn't be considered an Isser? Elamath, by that logic, what if a person puts a grain of wheat and a grain of barley in his hand? Which, if you were to plant them next to each other, you would be over on an Issa Kilai Zerim. The Zora Chita Ba'aret Zora B'chutbaret. Let's say you planted the wheat in right inside the border of Eretz Yisrael, and the barley grain right outside the border, so like literally, you know, they're a couple of inches apart on two sides of the line. Hachinami to Mechayev, are you going to tell me you'd be Chayev? Of course not. So why should you think you should be Chayev in the case of the A? What? Because Kilai Zerim only applies in Eretz Yisrael, yeah. Amri, so the answer, Hachi Hashta. How do you think to compare those two cases? Hasam Eretz Makom Chiyuva Chutzlaret Loi Makom Chiyuva. In that case, of the wheat and the barley, yes. Kalai Zeroy, the issue of it only applies in Eretz Yisrael, not in Chutzlaret. So yes, if you were to plant the wheat and barley together in Chutzlaret, you wouldn't be overrun in Yisrael either. So yes, the fact that one of them is in Chutzlaret, yeah, that saves you from an issue. But over here, we just established before that the chiyuv kalayim does apply to two land animals. It does apply to two water animals. No, anything. Kalai behemoth. Applies, forget about Eretz Yisrael versus not. It applies on land. It applies in the water. What makes you think it shouldn't apply to one on land and one on water? And that's in fact a maskana that we say that it is in fact usur, and if we say and it is in fact usur and
it applies separately either on land or on water.
So and therefore it should apply to one on land and one on water as well. I think if I remember correctly, what the Rambam says is actually it says the Gemara leaves it as a suffix, and therefore you wouldn't get malchus for it, but it's still usur. It's a suffix because the Gemara didn't say Hadron Alakshar Shinoga from the Torah. Now we've talked about the dinim of Keren, we've talked about the dinim of Burr, and now we're on to the next two Avos Nezikin, Shein and Rego, which are going to be the subject of the first half of this Perek, and then afterwards the second half of the Perek is going to talk about Eish. And then we'll have covered all the Avos Nezikin, and then the rest of the Masechta, pretty much all the rest of the Masechta after that, from the seventh Perek onward, is going to be Nizke Adam, Nizakim that are caused by a person. Mishnah starts up. If somebody gathers together his sheep into a pen, we'll see in the Gemara why Dafke mentions sheep as opposed to often. Sure. We're talking about all this time, yeah. the null before Nakoroi, and he locked up the door of the locked up the door of the pen properly, the yot of Izik, and the animal still got out and called Izik, potter. And he's potter because he did what was expected of him. Loy null before Nakoroi, but if he didn't,
the walls were not
No. Well, obviously it means that the walls it means that everything was it. Yeah. We'll see in the Gemara. Loy null before Nakoroi, what if he didn't lock it properly? The yot of Izik, and it went out and called Izik. Chayim. Then he's hired because he didn't do a good job.
What? Second one is obvious from the first.
No, because the main point is that if it's not Karoi, we're going to see in the Gemara what's Karoi and what's Shaina Karoi. So it has to be established then.
Yeah. It has to be in the first part.
No, but that's the thing. That's
now Karoi, and then you say, look now.
So the Chiddush is that even if you did, the Chiddush is that even though Yosef Izika in the first case, because it's still Potter, but if you didn't do to that extent, if you didn't do Karoi, then you're going to be hired. Yeah. The chiddush is more in the first part.
Exactly. That's what
I'm saying. Okay. So once it mentions that, it had to mention the other one as well.
Well, thank you.
Because otherwise you would think that maybe okay.
Well, karoi, you okay. Mentioned it.
Yeah, because I mean we're going to have cases where nifritz of alayla continues the Mishnah. If the what if the war was broken open at night. Okay, or if robbers broke it open, the Yotzavizik, and it went out and caused damage, Potter, then he's Potter. Tosfos discusses two possibilities over here, what we mean about this Nifritz of Balayla. When we say Balayla, does it mean that if it was broken open during the day, then he would be Chayev? Because we assume that he knows about it. If it's at night, no. But why are we specifying Balayla? Is it because at night we don't expect that he heard about it? But suppose he hears about it at night, then he would be chayev. Or maybe not. Maybe Tosfos says even if he finds out about it at night, you still don't make him go out in the night and go to a tircha to try to round up the animals in the middle of the night in the dark, and therefore he'd be possible.
Because it's dangerous for him to go out.
Not dangerous per se. That might be dangerous, but whatever. It'd be a tircha. They didn't have sweet lights in those days, you know. Yeah. So those are the two possibilities Tosfos discusses. Okay. And Pratsuralistim is that Tosfos learns that when we say Pratsuralistim, the next thing in the Mishnah is like your listim, that if the listim actually took it out of the barn, listim chayavin, then the listim become chayav for any hezek that it does. Which Tosfos says the point of it is that. No, what? Because the previous case where Prasura Listim, Tosfos learned that if they only opened the gate or tore down the wall or whatever, but did not actually take the animal out, as a matter of fact, not only the owner will be potter, because for him it's an onus, they will also be potter for any damage. There's obviously higher for the damage to the wall, obviously. No, the listing by just opening the door, because they only opened it, but didn't actually take the animal out, Tosfos learned they will be potter.
So the Baal, who doesn't lock his door, he's higher. The Listim who open the door, then they're Potter or Hatanabi.
Because he has a responsibility to guard his animal. It's not their animal. If they didn't hoit the Yor, if they didn't take it out, they didn't do any kinyan on it or anything, at worst, they were Grumma. At worst, they were Grumma. A Grumma and a Zik and his Potter. The Rambam, by the way, learns a little differently. The Rambam says the key thing is not so much whether they list him or not. The key thing is, why did they break open, the Truva to the Chachmei Lunel about this? It really depends. What was the person's purpose in opening the door? Was it that the animal should go out and cause damage? In that case, yes, he would be silent. Or was it that he just wanted to... He didn't have any particular thing in mind, or maybe he wanted to steal the animal and then decided not to, or whatever it is. Then that's the case when the Mishnah is saying he'd be positive.
When the damage occurs in someone's shoes, the person who is in the other person's shoes is higher. Here, the listing.
The listing is fine. They didn't actually take out the animal. Again, if they took out the animal, it would be different. All they did is they opened the door. If they tore down the wall, obviously they're going to be higher for the wall, but they're not going to be higher for what the animal does, according to Tosfos, unless they actually take it out, or according to the Rambam, unless they actually had in mind that the animal should go out and cause damage.
So is this 10,000 heads of cattle, and they just open the doors, and these 10,000 heads of cattle swarm around on the fields around it, still possible?
They are a grumma. They didn't actually do anything. They did. They opened the door, but then yeah. Because then, of course, look, then what do you mean?
What do you mean, Nifritza?
Nifritza means it just fell down by itself. I should pursue a listing, though. Well, you could, I guess. You could, but then there's really nothing to be added by pursue a listing. Then there's no chiddush in it. Nifritza Belila or pursue a listing then amounts to the same thing.
Right.
If you're talking about the Baal HaBasis chiyuv, there's no difference between them. Once you're talking about the listing chiyuv, then there's a difference. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, let's carry on. Hinicha b'chama. Mishnah continues. If the owner left the animal in the sun, so he locked it up, but it was in the sun, then as the Gemara is going to say later on Rambam, that the animal is going to do anything it can to get out. Therefore, he's going to be chayev. Or shem loser b'cheres shoyt b'katan, or he gave it to a cheres shoyt b'katan to watch. The Yosavizik, and it goes out and causes Nezek Chayev, then he will be Chayev. In the case of the sun, because that's not considered a valid Shemitah for it, you know the animal is going to do whatever it can to get out. And in the case of the Chayev, because they're not competent to watch it. Or even, they may even if you left it with them tied up, they may untie the rope. We talked about that earlier in the sentence. Mosra L'Roya, if you give the animal to a shepherd to watch, Nichnas L'Roya Tachta, then the shepherd takes over for you as far as the Chiyur for Nizikin. So the Gemara will ask later what the Chiddush in that is, we'll get there. Nafal Agin of Nenis. Now, we talked earlier in the Sechta briefly, and in our paragraph we're going to deal with it in more detail, about the difference when you pay for the actual value of what the animal damaged versus when do you pay for the Hanah. So earlier in the Masechta, we talked a bit about it in terms of whether an animal eats something that's normal for it to eat versus not normal for it to eat. Something that it would usually eat versus something that it could eat al-dat chak or whatever. Here we're going to be talking about it in connection with an animal causing damage in somebody's garden, for example. So we have the mashi zika, which will be the actual amount. So you figure out the actual value of what it damaged, and the owner is going to pay that amount, versus mashi menis, which is you figure out. And in the case of eating things, for example, it means, we said there, you figure out what would be an equivalent amount of straw or barley or whatever it is that you would normally feed the animal that now you're gaining, you don't have to feed that because it ate something else. Here it's going to be a similar concept, but a slightly different. So, nothing will begin of an anus. If an animal falls into somebody's garden and it benefited, namely benefited from it, so it fell, it was an onus, it didn't go in there deliberately. So you can't make the owner chayev for everything. Now, it fell on payers and damaged them, for example. You can't make the owner pay the full value of those payers because the animal didn't go in there deliberately. What he pays is mashinem, the amount that it benefited. Which means, for the pashtos, it means that the animal gained from the fact that it landed on something soft. It didn't land on the ground where it would have broken all its bones. So therefore, you have to figure out the value of that hanah. As far as you say, what you do is you work with the owner to figure out like how much would he have been willing to pay for there to be. If the animal is going to fall off a roof, how much would he have been willing to pay for there to be a mattress there or something for it to fall on? And that's the amount you pay. Yoda Kedalka Bizika, on the other hand, if the animal goes down into the garden the normal way and causes the hezek, mashalam is mashi zika, then you pay according to how much the hezek is, according to the actual value. But
according to
the hezek. Case in mashalam is mashi zika. How do we figure out how much it actually damaged? Now let's say for example it went into the garden and ate one entire plot of plants that were growing there. We don't want to say that you look only at that plot, how much was it worth with the plant and how much was it worth without. Because the mazik would end up losing out by that. The difference between a plot of land that's full of plants and one that's bare of plants, for example, is a huge difference. Instead, what you do is shaman base saw by the sada. What we do is we look at the value of a whole base saw in that field. A base saw is the area where you can plant a saw, reed, or barley, it's 50 by 50 amas. Kama hoitse yofa v'kama hi yofa. Altogether, that whole base saw, how much was it worth before? How much is it worth now with one missing aruga in it? And the point is, therefore, that comes out better for the market. You know, To put it in modern terms, for example, you know, you could have, for, you know, if you have, let's say, for example, if your car gets dented, you know, the car itself still has a value. The dent takes away a certain amount of its value, but not as much as if you were talking, you know, the difference between the value of the piece of metal itself before it was broken and afterwards. But if you consider the whole value of the car, the difference is not as much, basically. So that's what you do over here. Reb Shimon Omer. Reb Shimon says, however, I agree to that in general, but also peiros gemurim, but if the animal ate fully ripe fruit, mishalom is peiros gemurim, then you actually pay according to the value of the actual ripe fruit. You don't figure out based on a base saw. Im saw saw being im saw sign for sign. If it ate one whole saw of fruit, you're going to pay the value of a saw of fruit, two saw, then two saw. None of this shaman based saw.
So in other words, you add whatever it is. It ate.
So in other words, according to Reb Shimon, if it had eaten unripe fruit or vegetables or what have you, then you would do what we just said. You take the value of base saw, how much it's worth with all its crops, minus how much it's worth with all of the crops except for the one plot, and the difference is what the mask pays. Whereas if the fruit in that plot was fully grown, then Reb Shimon says you look at the actual value of that amount of fruit, which means the mazik is going to pay more in that case.
Why would you do it so differently from one case to another?
Wait, we'll learn about it later on in the parak and Bimar. Yeah. Turn it up on. Ezel karoi vezel shaloi karoi. What is the definition of the Mishnah that said that you lock the door karoi versus not karoi? What's considered karoi and what not? Delos shechol lamed beruach mitzuya. If the door, or the walls for that matter, are strong enough to stand in a normal wind, zel karoi, that's considered karoi. If it's something that can't even stand in a normal wind, that would be considered shaloi karoi. Not just wind. The Marshal says obviously it doesn't just mean wind. It means any of the normal things that might be expected to knock down a wall or what have you. So that's what I mean. It means ruach has an example. The ruach is a typical thing that might knock down a wall. But yeah, obviously it would apply to anything else.
The Marshal
says that it means anything else. It means first of all, it means obviously the wall and the gate have to be strong enough to withstand the animal itself under normal circumstances.
Yeah.
But whatever other things might cause a wall to get damaged. I'm going to mani by patish. Man tana mur b'sagile b'shmira kosa. Okay, but now let's consider the case of our Mishnah. And we're talking about an animal which is moored. Why? Because we're talking about Shein and Regel. We established earlier in the Masechta that only with Keren is there a difference between Tam and Moored. When it comes to Shein and Regel, there's no difference. An animal is always moored for Shein to eat things that it normally eats, for Regel to trample things that it would normally when it walks and then tramples things as it normally does. So an animal is moored always for those things. We're telling us in the Mishnah that no, but for now, karoi, you'll be potter, and loy nar karoi, then he's chayev, implying, as long as you have, again, what do we just say? As long as it's enough to stand in a ruach mitzuya, that's good enough. If a hurricane were to come, it would knock down the wall, not your problem. So we see from that, evidently, that the Mishnah seems to be implying that with a mu'ad, it's good enough to do shmira kusa, to do the least amount of shmira, and that's considered valid. And then you posture. Which Tana says that? The answer is Rabbi Hodi. Tznan, we learned previously in the Masechta, the end of the fourth parak, Koshred Baila V'Maisera, if the owner tied the animal with a halter, with a rope, Benal upon a Karoi, or if he locked the door Karoi properly, and the Karoi is the same definition as we just said over here, Ruach Matsuya, the Yot of the Hizik, and the animal goes out and damages, Echad tam ve'echad muad chayev, divrei Reb Meir. So the mayor says, regardless whether the animal is tam or muad, you're going to be chayev. You should have done shmira ma'ula. You should have done a high level shmira, not just a meisera, not just a regular door. You should have put chains on it. You should have put a stormproof door. Reb Yehuda, tam chayev muad potter. Reb Yehuda had said there that if the animal is tam, you're going to be chayev. If the animal is a muad, though, you're going to be potter. Shenema, the pasuk says, "V'lo yishmurenu ba'olav," because the pasuk says by muad that you're chayev because you didn't guard the animal. The shomer who's that? In this case, you did guard it. We learned over there the svara.
So why did he say both?
That's what Rabbi Huda is saying. A tam, you have to do shmir ma'olav. A muad, it's enough shmir ma'olav. We learned over there. We had a whole discussion over there why Rabbi Meir says differently because he learns from other pesukim. But according to Rabbi Yehuda, so we said the underlying svara, we said the Meiri says the svara might be, because when an animal is moored, everybody knows to be careful about it. So okay, that wouldn't totally work over here, because here we're talking about shame and regal. It's not something that people that you have to be careful of per se, but well, you know that animals always moored, but whatever. The point is, according to Rabbi Huda, that if an animal is moored, you're potter. Okay, we said they're potter. We had Rav Abba's opinion over there that you're only potter from the moored angle. You're still chayav on the tam angle. We talked about that over there. Again. And Rabbi Eliezer in the Shmira Lafakin. And we said over there a third opinion that Rabbi Eliezer had said, or Rabbi Eliezer had said, that the only valid Shmira for an animal that's moored is to shecht it. We talked about there, does he actually mean that as a matter of halacha, or does he just mean it as a matter of to be yotze yidei shemayim? Whatever, the point is, when our Mishnah is saying that you lock the door in front of the sheep, karoi, and then you potter, that has to be according to the Yehuda. It wouldn't work according to the mayor, because according to him you need shemira ma'ula for a mord, and it certainly wouldn't work according to the halacha, yeah. The Gemara says, no, I feel the tamer of mayor. No, you could even say that our Mishnah does go according to the mayor, which we'd prefer to. Mayor had said, you need Shemir Ma'ula for a word. We would prefer to say that our Mishnah goes like a mayor, because Stam Mishnah is a mayor. Why? Because Shani, Shane Bedegel, that Torah Miyata Bishmirat. And it's different when it comes to Shane Bedegel, because the Torah actually teaches us that with those, as well as some of the other Abbas Nezikin, as we're going to talk about now, the Torah specifically tells us that you don't need the maximum shmira to be potter in those cases. Meaning, Rav Meir would say that when it comes to a sure goring, the Torah is telling us that you need shmira ma'ula for a tam, and we learn from that to a mord as well. You disagree with Rav Yehuda's limud on halei shmira. But in the cases of the very of several of the other avos nezikin, you don't need the Torah. The Torah tells us by implication for those that shmira poter is enough.
So Shmira Pusa on which?
The Shmira Pusa for an animal would be that you lock the door with a normal door that will withstand a normal wind.
Right, but in which case is you saying no?
We're going to say Shein V'Regel among them. Shein V'Regel among
them.
So even, in other words, even though Shein V'Regel are moored, in the sense that even the first time they do it, you're going to chayv nezek shalom, unlike Karen, where you get a break in the first couple of times, you're going to do chayv nezek. On the other hand, though, when it comes to Karen, the Torah is telling us that you're chayev in the shmira, in maximum shmira, and otherwise you're going to be chayev, even when the animal is tam. On the other hand, with Shane Regel, you're not. Even on the one hand, they have a chumra that they're moored mitzvot, and on the other hand, they have a kula that a Torah miyata b'shmira. And the Torah tells us that a lesser level of shmira posa is enough. The Amr of Allah, the Amr of Masnis Tana, as in fact we see that Rabbi Elazar says, or others say that we learn in our Braitha, our Ba'ad Dvarim, our Torah Miyata B'Shmirata. There are four things that the Torah tells us that a minimum level of Shmira is enough for them. Once you do the minimum level of Shmira, then you're puzzled. The Elohim, Bur V'Eish Shein V'Regel. How do we see that? Bur, Dichtiv, Ki Yichtach Ish Bur, Ki Yichre Ish Bur, V'lo Yichasenu. The Pasuk says, we quoted the Pasuk in the previous parak when we were learning all about Bur, that if a person opens a Bur, meaning that it was already a Bur dug and then covered up and he reopens it, Oy Ki Yichre Ish Bur, or if a person digs a Bur newly, V'lo Yichasenu, and he doesn't cover it, and an animal falls in, then he's chayev. Hakisahu potter, which implies as long as he covered it, then he's potter. That's shmira potter.
Why?
Okay, so Rashi explains. So between Rashi and Tosfos, there's three different explanations. Rashi says that the point is that if we were to say that you need shmira ma'ula by a burr, then just covering it wouldn't be enough. You'd actually have to refill it in to be potter. The fact that the Torah is telling us not. The fact that the Torah is telling us you can put a cover on it. It has to be a solid cover, obviously. It has to be, like we learned in the previous parak, something that'll be able to handle the foot traffic in that area, the oxen or the camels or what have you that go through the area. But once you have that, you don't have to refill it in.
And that's the
that's the shmira posa, yeah. So that's Rashi's explanation. Then Tosfos gives an explanation that Tosfos starts by saying, if the Torah was requiring you to put a kisui me'ula, a really high-level kisui, something that won't deteriorate 100 years, that's pretty much the equivalent of filling in the burr. And we see the Torah just tells us v'loy chasenu, implying that even a cover that's not quite so solid as that, only solid to last for a reasonable amount of time under the local foot traffic, is enough. Loy chasenu means he didn't cover it. So the Gemara, Tosfos starts by saying that the Gemara is taking it as a given that if you had a kisui meula, then that would be pretty much the equivalent of having to fill in the burr. And we see the Torah doesn't require you to fill in the burr; it just requires you to put a cover, implying therefore that even not such a kisui meula is good enough. Also, Tosfos says another thing is that we have again the Torah mentions that a person digs a burr or that he opens a burr, which means there's a certain equation between them. So what happens if you open up a burr? I mean, there was a lid on it already. All you have to do is put back the lid, right? So there's no reason to think that if you dig a new pit, a new burr, that you should have to put on any stronger lid on this than that. In both cases, it'll be the same kind of lid, the same kind of cover, and therefore that's shmirta posa. But based on all these various explanations, the point is we see that the Torah is implying that all you need is the minimum acceptable covering that will actually withstand the foot traffic in the area, and that's enough. You don't need to fill in the burr, you don't need an extra strong cover, etc.
Everybody agrees on that?
Yes. Because that's the implication for the pasuk, yeah. Eish, where do we see by Eish the Torah tells us you only need a minimum level? Dichtiv shalom yishalom ha-maver tabera, because the pasuk says the one who set the fire should pay, meaning ad da'ovet kein mavir. The word ha-mavir is sort of extra, because it could have said shalom yishalom ha-tabera, so it teaches us only if you act as a mavir, only if you were peshe, only if you were careless and didn't put enough of a fire break or whatever around your fire, as we'll learn later on, the details of that,
Someone who ignites it.
Right, but the point is, in other words, so if a person lights a fire in its own chotzer and doesn't make sure there's enough space around it, and therefore it's able to spread into somebody else's property, that's peshea. That can be called hamaver tabeira. He set a fire which now is capable of easily getting into the other guy's property. But if, as long as he put a proper fire break around it, we're not worried, as we'll learn later on in the parak. Even though, again, ruach sheni mitzvah, an unusually strong wind could push it over into the guy's property, not our concern. But that's not a maver et abeira. He didn't do something that would
mean
that. Okay. Shein d'chtiv u'viyu b'steacher. We see by shein that the Torah tells that the Torah implies that you don't need shmir mula, because the pasuk says when he chayev by shein. It says u'viyu b'steacher if he grazes in somebody else's field. Again, abda obed ke'en u'viyu. Only if he does it as a beer, for example, that he literally feeds the thing to the animal, or that he's preshea and does something that carelessly allows the animal to go in there and feed. Again, once he put up a gate, then that's enough, even though it's shmir
posa. Even though this is
posa. Yeah. But that's the point, because that's not a beer anymore. You can't say that he's directly responsible for the animal going in and grazing. And regel, the stiv v'shilach, by regel, because the same pasuk is v'shilach, that he lets his animal go. Again, ad da'ovet kein v'shilach. It means that he lets it go, again, that he doesn't lock it up. And v'tanya, and we learn in a b'laisa, which we learned back at the beginning of the Masechta, how do we know that v'shilach means regel or v'yur means shein? V'shilach zeh regel, the word v'shilach refers to the damages that an animal does with regel. V'shilach literally means he lets loose. As we have a pasuk in Yeshayim, those who let loose the foot of the ox and the donkey. So we see that shalach means to send. Shilach, the Malbim talks about it. Shalach means to send. Shilach means to let go. It means to let loose, like it. Ubir zehashen, and the word ubir means. Tooth means when an animal eats. As the pasuk says that the Yeravam's family will be destroyed like an animal devours the golol until it's finished. We learned at the beginning of the Masechta a couple of different explanations what golol means in this connection. Either golol means waste, like an animal chews up the food and eventually it produces waste, or golol means marble because the teeth are hard like marble. Anyway. So we see what Golol is the Aramaic word for it. In Bachem, the Evan Golol is Pasuk in Sefer Ezra. So therefore we say yeah. So So you see that Vashilach means regal, and Onavir means shame. Okay. So therefore, time to obtain Vashilach or beer. So we see why you chayim only if you acted in a way of Vashilach or in a way of a beer. But if you didn't do Vashilach and you didn't do a beer, then you're takapatim. So therefore, we see that by those two, as well as by the other two, you have Shmir of Chos as an act. Omer Rav, masnisin nami deita. As a matter of fact, we can see that from the wording of our Mishnah. Because our Mishnah mentions sheep. Now, sheep are not usually capable of doing damage with Karen. In principle, the sheep don't have they don't have wounds, but remember, there are tolls of Karen. Remember, there's biting, kicking, and whatnot. But sheep are generally pretty docile creatures. They don't usually do those things. So, because after all, Mechti B'Sherkach skin involved. Because after all, in the previous prakim, all the illustrations that we always had always used Sher, Nisni Sher. So why doesn't our parak also start out kind of Sher the deer? And Maishna the Katani Tzoyin. Why does it mention sheep? Lav Mishum Datzera Miyatzer B'Shemunatzan. Evidently, because the Gemara evidently because the Mishnah wanted to hint at this idea that when it comes to animals, when it comes to a Sher with the capability of Keren, then you need Shemira Mola. Again, according to the mayor in all cases, and according to the beholder, only if it's cat. But only if it's cat, yeah. But in the case of Tzayin, where Keren is not really an issue, the issue is only Shem Redego, then Benob, for now, Koroi, Shemir Posa is enough.
And that's why we start with
Tzayin, yeah. And the Gemara continues, Lav Mishum Dekan Keren like Sivba, Shein Verdagol de Sivbe. And after all, isn't it because over here, I'm sorry to hear that it gives a tzoin, that when it comes to sheep, the Torah doesn't use the word Keren in connection with sheep, only in connection with oxen. Shein Verdagol de Sivbe, the Torah only mentions in connection with sheep, the Shein Verdagol, the Kamash Malam, the Shein Verdagol, the Mu'ad in Hu. And therefore, the Mishnah is telling us that Shein and Regol, which are Mu'ad, and that Shane and Regal, which are more of a however, you do have that kula that we said that Atorah Miyasa B'Shmirah. The Torah is implying you need only a lesser Shmirah, and therefore that Benav of now Karoi is enough. Shmamina, so that would prove it. So from the fact that the Mishnah uses the word sign, in other words, proves that when you have a case where Keren is not an issue, where it's only Shane Verego, even though the animal is more Mitchilasan, to for Shane Verego, Shmirah Pchosa is enough. There's a whole different gear over here that the Marshal seems to have, and that's in a number of Pisvayad, where actually the Gemara, where actually from the Lav Mishum Dekan is actually the Gemara asking back on Rava. That the Gemara is asking the Gemara is asking back on Rava that maybe it's not what you're saying. Yes, of course, the Mishnah mentioned
Mishum Dekan, Well,
there's a slightly different view, so there's slightly different wording in these kitzvayad, but the gist of it is that the Gemara is asking back and saying, you're telling me that because it only says tzoyin implies that if there's not an issue of Karen, then all you need is Shmira Posa, but maybe not. Even though it doesn't say Karen by Tzoyin, it does say Shane and Regal. Maybe on the contrary, maybe because Shane and Regal are Mord, maybe the Torah would be implying that you need Shmira Mola for them. So you can't prove that from our Mishnah. Because Shane and Regal are Mord Mitzvah,
son. So why would it start with Karen then?
So fine, so the Mishnah mentioned Tzoyin, but maybe on the contrary. Maybe you're telling me that Nol B'Chomer Karoi means that Shmira Posa is enough, and therefore you're telling me that the Mishnah is like Rabbi Yehuda? Maybe not. Maybe actually the Mishnah is not like Rabbi Yehuda. Maybe it's in fact like Rabbi Meir. Yeah. That you need Shmira Me'ula. No, but for now, Karoi would actually have to mean Shmira Me'ula. And Chaket, therefore, that's why the Torah would be telling us, that's why the Mishnah would be mentioning Tzoyin, to tell us, even though Tzoyin have only Shane Verdegel, not Karen, nevertheless, because they're Mu'ad Mitzchilasan, and according to the Meir, anything that Mu'ad needs Shmira Me'ula, therefore, you need Shmira Mola.
So you could try.
You could argue back that way, and therefore that destroys Rabba's conclusion. Mm-hmm. Which those two ways of explaining the Gemara also affect who the actual halacha is like. The halacha, as far as the Tam and Mord business, is like Rabbi Yehuda. If you say that our Mishnah is like Rabbi Yehuda, then fine, that works out nicely. We have Machlokas there. Now we have a Sam Mishnah like him, and the halacha is like him. Whereas if the Gemara can understand that our Mishnah is like the mayor, then it creates a problem. Why is the halacha like a Rabbi Yehuda after all?